heard my my story along those lines. I've been criticized for bringing up this unpleasant situation to people who have lived through Sandy and have lost loved ones. What looks like drowning, and I think it's really electrocution. But this is a unknown factor that a lot of people are not familiar with, how extremely electrically conductive salt water is. And if there's anything in that basement that has electrical power and you're in that water, you're putting yourself at a huge risk. Lucky there were no fatalities there, but there were a number of fatalities in other places that looked like drowning, but I think they were electrocution. Over to you for any comment on this one, Russ. KC2LSB, K2RIW in the Tech Net.
Yeah, K2RIW in the entire Tech Net. Yeah, this is K2LSB. I shut the power down in my home, as the surge was coming. I didn't want any issues with that. Knowing the storm was coming, we had pulled a lot of stuff out of the basement up into the first and second floor of our house ahead of time, all the quote-unquote really important stuff. But I still had many thousands of dollars worth of gear down there of all different kinds, tools and the like. And trust me, it wasn't even a second thought that I should risk my life to go down there and touch any of it. It's not worth it. It can all be replaced. You can't. That's the words of wisdom. Anyway, back to that case. You too, I'll speak to you.
To Bravo Tango Mike.
Thank you an awful lot, Russ. First-hand information. I think it's K2 Bravo Tango Mike. I'm not sure of your prefix, but go right ahead. Start off with your name, your full call, and tell us anything you'd like to about the whole situation. Bravo Tango Mike, you've got it. K2 RIW in the TechNet.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Tango Mike. Thank you. It's David in Plainview, and it's my first time on this net, so hello to everybody. Just wanted to comment on the fuel supplies for different generators. As you correctly stated before, you've got natural gas, you've got propane, and you've got diesel fuel. When you talk about natural gas versus propane, you have to derate the kilowatt hour capacity of the generator because natural gas is just not as efficient as propane. So an 8 kW generator may only run at 6.5 kW. Over.
Yeah, that's a good point, David. Of those 4 kilowatt generators that I was selling, so to speak, right after Hurricane Gloria, they were rated 4 kilowatts on gasoline and on natural gas or propane. One or the other was something like 3.5 kilowatts. It is a lower energy density fuel. It's not less efficient, just a lower energy density of the fuel. But yes, you get less kilowatts output. And when you go to Generac, for instance, and you buy one of their generators that is intended to be used for natural gas, and they tell you the kilowatt rating, that's automatically there, if you know what I mean. And as you can tell from my earlier conversation, let me drop the exact number of kilowatts you need in your standby generator, in my opinion, is a slightly controversial subject. A lot of people have got different opinions on this. But for the very small number of hours per year or per decade that we have to run on a motor generator set, during those very small percentage of the time, you don't have to live in the lap of luxury. You can live a Spartan existence as long as you've got heat so your pipes are not freezing, electricity so your food is not spoiling in the refrigerator. Those are some of the main things you need, and after that it's other creature comforts. And so when I played Power Zone, when I'm running my hold-on house on a 1500 watt peak power motor generator set, I lived by my standards, even in the wintertime, very comfortable. And on one particular very bad winter day, I think it was 1977, we had a huge ice storm in January. I was not only powering my house, but I ran an extension cord from my house to my neighbor's house. And they were able to run their oil burner at the same time that I was running my stuff in my house, all on a 1500 watt generator. We had to be careful as to what we turned on, but at least we kept two houses from freezing for the number of days of that particular ice storm. So if you're willing to live a somewhat Spartan existence and realize, you know, what's important during that time. If you're willing to camp out a little bit, so to speak, then the number of kilowatts you need is a hell of a lot less than you think. Let me drop. K2GJE recognized. So a hell of a lot smaller power is sometimes sufficient. K2GJE, I should know your name, please tell me. K2RIW in TechNet, go right ahead.
And here we go. Good evening, Dick, you said. I know of a party in Nassau County that did not have natural gas. They buried a propane ball. I guess it depends upon local permits, and there was some distance that was required from the house where they dug the pit. Also, rather than using double-ended extension cords, there are very cheap four-circuit manual transfer switches available from local supply houses for around $300. Over.
Rich recognized. Yes, I've heard of those, Ed. And so if you're willing to do the transfer switch manually, and if you're willing to buy one that's available that can be added to your particular fuse panel, and if you're willing to start the generator by pressing a button because it's got a battery starter system, and you don't want everything completely automated, you can save quite a bit of money. That, may, of course, may not be appropriate for Rich's situation because he is a person who is living with a disadvantage, with a disability. So that, I guess, we've got more information for what you need. I know you're going to have to do some more research, Rich. N2, Echo Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, thank you very much. The only thing I want to find out, and it may not be the scope of this net, is there any type of financial help out there to install these things through National Grid or anything? I don't know if it makes any difference, but I'm on a disability pension. Patty is not well either. So I don't know. What I have found out is there's a lot of help out there, especially for disabled people. You just have to reach out, know where to go, and ask for it. Back to that.
CUX.
I'm at Dick.
Okay, something EUX is what it sounds like. I know there's a number of people trying to sign in. I'm going to take you one at a time. The person that sounds like EUX, give me your full call and your name, sir.
Sorry, Dick. Bill again, KC2CUX, Tango Uniform X-Ray. I was, while you guys were discussing this, I was searching Long Island Power Authority's website, and they have nothing that I can find regarding rebates or assistance. They have what they call the critical care program for persons with different disabilities. And bottom line on it, I'll read it to you from their website. Critical care program does not guarantee priority when there are major outages, referring to restoring your power. You are responsible for making alternate arrangements for any medical needs in the event of power outage. But I could not find anything at all about any type of a rebate or anything like that. KC2CUX.
I thank you for that research, Bill. Okay, so we got some direct information, so to speak. Let's see what John's got to say on this. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick. First of all, I believe Richie has oil heat, so he's burning number two fuel. His best bet would be to get a diesel generator. And if he calls GenX or any of those companies that are doing these installations, or even the contractors, the GCs, they would know if there's help available or somebody that could augment some kind of help payments. That would be the place to go. Talk to the people who know, and you can find out. And there might be available some funding for that. So that's a good thing to research. But he already has fuel on board, so I don't think he should go for a gas type. And oil will give him the therms that he needs to run that generator. That's it. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
And 2APG. Okay. Dave is right after Wes. And so, by the way, anybody who's on frequency right now, if you know of a method by which a person with a physical disability trying to install uninterruptible power at his house by way of a motor generator set can be getting financial aid, it's one of the things that Rich has been asking from the very beginning. Let's see if Wes has got an answer on that one. N2XJN, K2LAW.
No, I do not have on that one, but you were talking about energy density, and I would like you to tell something more about it, versus which material and what density of the energy density is the best for generating the electricity, if we will, and to exchange.
I haven't studied it from the point of view of how many joules you get per gallon, so to speak, of these various fuels, or joules per cubic foot. By way of the generator that was a triple fuel generator that I was involved in, with the getting 500 of them on Long Island for primarily the AIL employees as well as a few of their friends, we knew that that generator running on gasoline or liquid propane would produce the 4 kilowatts. And when it ran on natural gas, I believe it was only 3.5 kilowatts. So the energy density, you look at any of the manufacturers of a multi-fuel generator, they will show you a smaller number of watts for the exact same size of generator when it's running on natural gas. So
a bit wider with different types of fuels.
I only know natural gas, liquid propane, and gasoline. To my knowledge, oil and gasoline is very close to the same number of joules per gallon.
Whitey white.
Okay.
Whitey white.
Well, the energy.
Whitey.
The amount of. Is this according to the origin of the space unit, there would be volumes or mass. But then, very quick, I don't want to take too much time of you guys. Coal, we've been using coal and the Stirling engine in the past, and that happened to be still very much used, and the Stirling engine is used in many applications, even cooling. Let me drop. But thorium has nearly 200 times the energy of uranium, cannot blow. It's easy to dig. You go to the beaches of Canada, and because temperature of melting of thorium is only 500 degrees, you collect that sand, you put it into the oven, and you have a liquid. That liquid is the thorium. That the thorium, as it is ready to be used. Simply like that. And so we're talking about 200 times energy density. It's less radioactive than your bananas that you eat every day or every few days.
Wes, I've got to interrupt you. We are discussing motor generators for power in people's backyard. You're getting very far off subject here. Dave, N2APG, tell us what you were going to say, Dave.
Hi, good evening, Dick and Annette, N2APG. Just a couple of quick comments regarding the topic at hand, which falls under the category of emergency preparedness as a whole. And while it's a little bit late in the game right now for somebody like Rich to, you know, get an emergency generator set up, there are some steps he can take to mitigate circumstances that may come out of this particular storm. In particular, if he loses power, his house is going to get kind of cold. So there's still a possibility of tomorrow for somebody to go out and purchase some sort of auxiliary heating unit, which is not going to heat the whole house, but will keep him warm in a room, so to speak, to survive a power outage. And a couple of just two other things I wanted to mention, Dick.
specifically for Rich and people like him who are in a situation where, in an emergency, they would need assistance to get out of the house. There's two things that that he can do. Number one, he should contact, if he hasn't done this already, he should contact his local fire department and let them know his situation. And they will put that information into the computer so that any alarm that comes in at his house, they'll automatically know there's somebody in that house that needs assistance to get out of the house. And that can be a life-saving situation in a pinch. And there's also a website called, I believe it's smart911.com, smart911, where you give them the same information, anything pertinent, and they pass that information along to the local police department. So any 911 call that comes in for his address, they'll also have that similar information. Back in it, Dick.
That's very good information, Dave. I believe for a period of time you were a volunteer of the Massapequa Fire Department. As such, you probably know of a number of residents that reported that kind of information to their local fire district. Is that true, Dave? And to APG, K2LIW?
Well, I'm aware that most fire departments have that feature available. I know for sure that Massapequa has that available, where you call up their non-emergency phone number in the daytime, and you just give them that information that, you know, you have a person at that residence that needs assistance to get out of the house for whatever reason. And they put that in the computer, and then anytime there's an alarm at that house, that's automatically broadcast to the units that are responding that, you know, there is somebody in that house that's going to need help to get out, and that becomes the, you know, the immediate priority. So that's a good thing. And, you know, again, on the topic of emergency preparedness, you know, there's a lot of things. Go online and do a little search on that, emergency preparedness, whatever, Office of Emergency Management. There's all sorts of good checklists and things like that of, you know, things that you can purchase to get into your house to be prepared for emergencies, no matter what it is. Every situation's different. Rich might need, you know, to make sure he has a supply of medication for a week or two, you know, if he can't get out of the house due to snow and this and that. So there's a lot of things that you can, you know, that you can purchase ahead of emergencies that, you know, you're prepared to get through the emergency on your own without outside help.
KG2 BTM.
BTM, recognized, you're right after Bill, YDY. N1YDY, tell us how you survive a significant power outage if you do in Port Washington, Bill. N1YDY in the group, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, gentlemen, and hello to all. I haven't been on since the holidays, so Happy New Year to you all. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that I worked in aviation. We described fuel density, as you call it, or power density. We measured it in BTUs per pound, because the fuel, as you probably know, jet fuel expands and contracts with the various temperatures, and so that's essentially the same for diesel fuel, since kerosene is very similar. The other thing is that, you know, being prepped, I've always found a diesel generator is reasonably easy to maintain. The problem with the gas generator is that when you're done with it, you really have to clean it out so that the carburetor doesn't gum up. Let me drop it in one way. So the type of generator that requires the least maintenance is the ones with the natural gas, because you don't have to disassemble and clean the carburetors when you're done. But for some reason, the diesel ones seem to be fairly safe. It's fairly easy to get diesel fuel, and a smaller tank of diesel fuel will still give you, storing it in your garage or your house someplace, will still give you enough power to get the job done and get using your idea of reducing your total electrical demand. They call that load management in marine usage.
Good information, Bill, and you're absolutely right. My gasoline-powered snowblower, I have to put the stabilizing fluid into the fuel tank, in order to store it over the summer. You're supposed to run all the fuel, turn off the fuel supply, and run off all the fuel out of the bowl of the carburetor, and or put in the stabilizing fluid. So maintaining the operability of a gasoline-powered motor generator set, you got to worry about the fact that the fuel sitting there for, let me pick a number, more than a couple of months, is liable to turn into gum, and really literally gum up the works as far as the way that carburetor and float valve mechanism is supposed to work. The next person who signed in with some information is a BTU, sound like Baker Tango, Mike, I'm not sure. Give me your full call letters and your name, sir, and then proceed with your information. K2LIW on the TechNet, my name is Dick.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Tango Mike, David in Plainview. Got a little bit of information for you. I bought a 3,000 watt generator back in 1973, and the first time I powered it up was first time I even put oil in it was for Sandy, and it started right up. However, when I measured the voltage coming out, it was like 150 volts, so we had to work on that before I connected it into anything. Let it drop. And just by way of reference, there's a company on the net you can take a look at. He's got a lot of different generators. It's powerequipmentdirect.com. Powerequipmentdirect.com. They deliver to your door with either a loading platform, truck, or you need to arrange to get it off the truck. And they ship reasonably, and I don't think there's a state sales tax on that. Let it drop. Also, when you're talking about transfer switches, there's another way to do this, and that's to put a mechanical interlock on your main circuit breaker. In other words, you connect two auxiliary breakers into your panel, you put a mechanical interlock between those two breakers and the main breaker. Let it drop. Doing that, only one set of breakers can be on at any time, either the main or the two auxiliaries, and that would serve as a transfer switch. KT2 BTM.
Some more good information. I thank you, Dave. And lots of ways to do it, as you can tell. There was a comment I was going to make on something you said earlier, but that company, PowerEquipmentDirect.com, sounds like a good one to consider. Oh yes, the 150 volts. There's two things to worry about with a motor generator set. Number one, because they know that the average person is going to be using it through a fairly long extension cord, they tend to set the voltage quite a bit higher than the 120 volts we'd like to get, knowing that there's going to be line drop. Second of all, another thing you have to worry about, and this came out in Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy, for a lot of people, and that is a motor generator set, with rare exception, does a fairly poor job of maintaining exactly 60.0 hertz, cycles per second, of generator running speed, so to speak. The actual frequency they run at, let me drop, is always usually a little bit higher, like 61 hertz, but it's continuously varying. When it comes to running clocks, that's a minor problem. Your clock's going to run a tiny bit fast. However, when it comes to a UPS system that is the standby power for your computer, what 90% of the people running on a motor generator set discovered during Sandy is that their UPS system was extremely unhappy with that frequency. The way the computer is set up in the vast majority of the available UPSs these days is that if you deviate more than, let me pick a number, half a hertz from 60 hertz, it assumes that Loco or LIPA or Con Ed is in the process of getting a failure. Therefore, they go into the trip-out mode. They go into the mode of running on their own battery, so to speak. And so, because the motor generator set is continuously varying in frequency, the UPS keeps tripping back and forth. It's operating its relays continuously, and therefore, quite a significant number of them did go into a failure mode. They didn't properly charge. They didn't. They eventually failed, if you know what I mean. If you're trying to, just because you've got a motor generator set and you think you've got power, and if you think, therefore, your computer is going to be running like a charm through the UPS. The UPS is extremely unhappy. I know of a commercial installation of a major fire department that was running on a Generac liquid propane powered generator. I think it was the 18 kilowatt size. Or was it the 8 kilowatt size? 13 kilowatts. It was a 13 kilowatt Generac running on a liquid propane tank. And that in turn was powering a very large standby UPS system to power their communication equipment. The UPS kept going into a failure mode because of that generator. And the only choice they had was to go to the Generac model that was 18 kilowatts and diesel powered, because that was the first model of the Generac company that had a computer controlled speed control that maintained 60 hertz with high reliability. Therefore, the UPSs didn't trip out. So that's something to consider. Motor generator said you can, with 90% probability, you can assume that your UPS is going to be unhappy on that power. And how we get around that, I'm not sure. I guess one possible solution would be right. Takes over when LIPA or Con Ed goes down, therefore we don't lose the document. So that's one possible solution. Know that you've got to operate the computer in a slightly more protective manner. In other words, let me drop.
1YDY.
Bill recognized you could, as you're writing a document, continuously store portions of that document, put it into storage mode so you don't lose it. Because you're running in the non-UPS mode, if you know what I mean. That's one possible solution. Let's see what you recommend on this one, Bill. N1YDY, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, and not to be funny, but my name is actually Hank. It's the middle name, William Henry, so I go by Hank. There's a company called Fisher Panda, and Fisher Panda uses various engines from different manufacturers, Yanmar and others, Kubota. But they create their own, what they call asynchronous genset. And the asynchronous genset is computer controlled, and so the speed of the engine is not directly the determinant of the frequency of the electrical output. Back, I don't know what they are today, but marine models back around 2010 for 6.5 kW was $12,500 unit, which was a bit more than most of their competitors. But they made a very reliable electrical output that motor power supplies were very happy with. Mighty one.
DC2FYJ with a question.
FYJ recognized. Yeah, that's good to know, Hank. When I looked you up, QRZ.com leads me to believe that your first name is William. Sorry about that. The method of generating electronically 60 hertz with, I guess it's really an inverter, powered by the raw power coming out of a motor generator set. That's one interesting approach. And you would think that somebody would generate, that would develop a governor-like system for the motor. As long as you can operate the carburetor fast enough on a motor generator set, you should be able to keep the motor very close to 60 hertz, as long as you don't have very, very cyclic power low. In other words, if you have some kind of a crazy appliance in your house that periodically is going to be adding and subtracting 2 kilowatts of load, like maybe a fish tank heater, then on each one of those transitions, it's going to take a while for the motor generator set to catch up. But those could be relatively brief periods, and maybe that would not fault along your UPS. The elaborate approach, of course, is electronic generation, which doesn't use the real rotary speed of the motor generator in its alternator. But to get that done inexpensively is a little bit of a problem. Although, for the guy that's crafty and willing to build an inverter, it's a very doable thing. KC2FYJ, K2RIW, go ahead with your information.
Well, number one, I was going to suggest that route. Use a generator that does DC, use it to charge the batteries, run the batteries through an inverter that gives you your solid 60 cycle. That's quite a bit more sophisticated, though, than the average homeowner is going to want to do. I know that's what they do in computer data centers to maintain the uninterrupted power for the computers. The other thing that I wanted to talk about for a minute was load balancing and sizing of generators, and I had an idea that I wanted to run past you. Just a second. In communication theory, switching theory, there's a formula called the Erlang formula, and the phone company uses it to decide just how many components they need to guarantee that with some percentage of probability, when a customer picks up the phone, they're going to get a dial tone. Because if everyone were to pick up the phone at the same instant, some of them would get dial tones and some wouldn't. And it's based on probability and such. And I'm just wondering if you could leverage that kind of formula into figuring out the probability of various components in your house going on and off and the load that they generate, and use that to determine with 95% or 98% probability what size generator would I need in order to power the house without having to be a power czar.
Yeah, my understanding of the telephone system Erlang loading analysis really is saying that if you've got the 10,000 telephone users out there, with rare exception, you're not going to get more than, let me pick a number, 20% of them demanding telephone service at any one time. And most of the time that works. You get a 9/11 event, and that system becomes jammed. So periodically it's going to fail on you. Now, in the case of your house, you and I could come up with a fairly good rough approximation on that one, Harry, by doing the following. In my case, I would be hurting it a little bit because for a whole bunch of reasons, I've intentionally undersized the fuel oil nozzle on my oil burner. Let me drop this. My oil burner used to have, I think it was either 9/10 or 1 gallon per hour nozzle, and I've lowered it to a 6/10 of a gallon per hour nozzle because the whole system runs a lot more efficiently that way. I'm now getting the right fuel air mixture. I'm getting a very clean burn. I don't make soot in my flue pipes. I get a round tan substance that I have to clean the flue pipes on my furnace once every 5 years, whether they need it or not. Whereas almost everybody has got to clean a huge amount of soot out of his flue pipes every single year because the service person has set it on such a very rich fuel-to-air mixture that they're getting a very smoky flame, which in turn is making carbon monoxide, which in turn is costing them more money. We won't get into that. Now, so I could realize that on a 30-degree day, my furnace runs, let's pick a number, 30% of the time. And it goes on and off, but I could find out how many hours, how many minutes it runs when it runs, and how many minutes there is in between runs. So in the case of your furnace, I could rate its duty factor. In the case of my refrigerator, I could rate its duty factor. In the case of the people running around the house, turning on lights and television sets and toasters, I could come up with an approximation. So I think you and I could come up with a kind of an Erlang loading for my particular house once I study those individual appliances. And therefore, I would come up with a conclusion, let me drop, that my 1,500-watt generator that I used to be using, I'm going to be exceeding 1,500 watts, twice per day. In other words, for some particular period during the day, I'm going to exceed 1,500 watts. I'm going to stall the generator, whatever the last appliance turned on, I'll have to turn it off and go out and restart the generator. During those few hours per year that I'm living on motor generator power, as bad as that sounds, to me, as a non-invalid person, that's a tolerable situation. If I was a person with a disability where I couldn't get there and restart it, I can see how that would be a problem. Well, if I'm a person with a disability, I probably automatically have an automatic start, a push-button start on the motor generator set. So it's something we can evaluate. But I'm convinced that almost every one of us can live on a hell of a lot less kilowatts for the few hours per year on the average year that it happens. That's my philosophy. Not everyone's going to agree with that. Anyone with any further questions or comments on motor generator sets, uninterruptible power during a superstorm Sandy, or this superstorm that's coming toward us in the next 2 days, give me a call letters right now, KQRIW and the TechNet.
KC2RFN.
Haven't heard from you in a long time, Alan. KC2RFN. Tell me how you've solved this problem. You got it, Alan.
Good evening, Dick. I was listening in on the generator issue, and after the superstorm, I decided to get the Generac put into my house as well. And I had them put in a 20K, so that even if all the air conditioning zones are on, the whole house can stay nice and cold. And happy to have it. And we've had a few blackouts around here, and the house was still running, and it's a wonderful thing. But then we lost power one night. It must have been about 1 in the morning, and the generator came on, and when everything is very, very quiet, and that generator comes on, even though it's a fairly quiet generator in of itself, you can hear that thing for blocks. And I knew when my neighbor came up to me the next day, and she said she had wondered if the blackout had just hit her house or was hitting the entire neighborhood. She knew when she heard my generator that it was probably the neighborhood. Bottom line is, the thing makes a lot of noise at night. And you and I bought it for summer. Now, even in the winter, you want to keep your oil burner going. Did you run into a problem with your neighbors complaining about noise? Or do you see that as a problem? I don't know what my neighbors could do about it. I don't know if there's zoning laws against it. But to have that motor running at 2 in the morning, I imagine you make a lot of enemies.
For me, it wasn't a problem, Alan, because where I live in Dix Hills is 1 acre zoning, and with 80-foot high oak trees between me and my nearest neighbor, and the nearest neighbor is 200 feet away, the sound of my generator getting there wouldn't be much of a problem for them. However, I do know that many of these motor generator sets, I'm guessing that 90% of them, really have an undersized muffler. I know of people who have put a better muffler on a motor generator set. 80% of the noise is coming out of the muffler. The actual rotary sound, let me drop. The sound coming directly through the crankcase of the motor and the alternator is very minor by comparison. So if you're willing to put on a better muffler, and yes, if it's in your case, I think you said a 15 kilowatt or 18 kilowatt generator, you're going to lose 10% of that power because the better muffler is going to give you a little bit more back pressure. But you have the resources to put on whatever muffler you like. And your generator might be located in its own little doghouse. And you could put some soundproofing in that doghouse. So I think the muffler is the better approach. I'd give that some thought, Alan. KC2RFN,
K2RFN.
Okay, Alan first, and then FYJ, Harry right after that. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay, I'll look into that. I don't know where I would go to have someone put a new muffler on there unless I have to jerry-rig it and figure it out myself.
Right now, I don't either. But you and I have resources. It ain't rocket science. I know we can find a way of doing it. If you look in an automobile supply house, aftermarket, the right size one, boy, they've got a zillion mufflers made for automobiles. Yeah, they're a little bit on the large side. But if it quiets it down, it's worth the try. So, yeah, it's going to require some kind of jury-rigging, I think. Let's see what Harry's got to say on this one. KC2FYJ, K2IW, the TechNet.
Well, we're all techno-geeks, and so there's an electronic techno solution to the muffler issue. You can put a microphone onto your system and sample the noise coming out of it and use that to generate a sound coming out of a speaker that is 180 degrees out of phase, and you inject that into your exhaust manifold. And lo and behold, coming out of the end of the pipe is no noise at all, more or less.
VTM.
Yeah, VTM, BTM. Oh, that's David. We'll get to you in a second, David. Doable, not easy.
sound canceling in an exhaust system. And to make that loudspeaker tolerate exhaust temperatures is an interesting trick. Yeah, I'll admit it's doable. I'd rather take the brute force approach and put on a larger muffler. And in the case of those 500 motor generators that I was involved in the sale, the distribution of, by the way, the distribution of 500 motor generators among employees, that process took almost 2 months. Some people never get around to picking up their generator and so on. And we hired various people to do some of the deliveries. It got complicated. Let's see, Dave, how would you solve the problem? KD2BT and M, K2IW and TechNet.
Roger, it's KD2BTM, Mike. Two thoughts on sound. One, you can put in a series of low-pressure mufflers and get the sound down tremendously. Second thought is you can go to a 1800 RPM generator, and they're rather expensive. I've only found one, and that was a 22 kW from Generac. It's their quiet series line, and it runs at 1800 RPM. And the third idea is you have to go with a water-cooled generator. Let it drop. Water-cooled generator tends to muffle all the noise that comes from the lower end of the generator, the crankshaft, the piston slap, all of that. And once you've got a decent muffler on, you'll realize that a lot of the noise is coming from the lower end of the motor. And that's hard to baffle without water cooling in a good doghouse. BT2, BTM clear.
Considering the way they make acoustic anechoic chambers, they make sound-absorbing foam that you can put on the walls of a chamber. It does a fantastic job of absorbing sound. And by the way, when you take a radio anechoic chamber and you stand in the middle of it, as I have on a number of hours of my life, you're amazed how quiet those things are. They're made to be radio absorbing, but that foam, those pyramid-shaped foams on the wall, the floor, and the ceiling, boy, do they do a job of absorbing sound. You get in the middle of that chamber and close the door, and you think you're not part of this world. It gets so darn quiet. So I think soundproofing of the doghouse, even without water, could be done. And as I see it, I've made a rough guess by studying my particular motor generator set. Let me drop. I've come to the conclusion that 80% of the sound is coming out of the muffler. I will admit that 3600 RPM, you do get a significant amount of other sounds coming out of the crankcase of the motor, and there the soundproofing of the doghouse, I think, could knock that down by 10 or 15 dB, if you know what I mean. So you're not going to make the sound of the motor generator set go to zero, but I guarantee you could cut it down to 5 or 10% of what it was without getting heroic. I'm reasonably sure of that, because I do remember at least one or two of those 500 people that bought the ones from Airborne Instruments Laboratory did go and do that and claim they were happy with the results. I wish now I could remember the name of those two people that did it. I'd like to find out exactly how they did it, but that was way back in Hurricane Gloria, 1985, and those things were all delivered to people in the spring of 1986. So there's a lot of water under the bridge since then. For all I know, those people have become silent keys. Anybody with any further questions or comments from all of the above on motor generator sets for uninterruptible power for Superstorm Sandy and the super snowstorm we're about to get, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet. Bless one eye. It sounded like Whiskey Sierra 1 India. If so, correct me and tell me your name, sir, and then please proceed. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Please wait for the beep.
Hey, Dick, Don. My name is, you got it right, Whiskey Sierra 1i. I just remember an old farmer that had a noisy generator, and his solution was using the existing muffler, but putting like a 30-foot piece of pipe before the existing muffler. But he had the room to do that. And also, I wanted to mention grounding of these, especially these temporary generators, how important that is. I know people sometimes put them on trailers and they don't ground them, but I just thought you'd touch on that. WS1I, back to Nick Control.
Good information, Don, from West Haven, Connecticut. When I go to your QIZ.com site, I see a massive earth-moving vehicle alongside of a four-wheeler, a private car. Quite possibly you use that machine, that cat machine. Looks to me like that can move a zillion tons of earth. Yes, muffler, the way they design a muffler on an automobile is that I think in many cases there is a tuned pipe in between the exhaust manifold of the engine and the muffler, and there's maybe another tuned pipe to the catalytic converter. When they put it all together, they do manage to do an extremely good job of acoustic soundproofing. The soundproofing that in a private automobile these days is really something that we take for granted. And if you have any doubt as to how much soundproofing is going on, let me drop. Just hook up with any one of your friends who is having a change of life event. In other words, he's 60 years of age and he's always dreamed about having a convertible automobile. And you take a ride in his convertible with the top up, and you realize that you have trouble talking to him on any of our modern highways. The sound of all the roads on the highway, plus the sound of his vehicle, plus the wind running by on that ragtop vehicle, so to speak, is an amount of sound volume that having a conversation, you're sitting in the passenger seat of his car, and I'm talking about, I think it was a real good, was it a Buick or was it a Cadillac? I'm not sure which it was, but a buddy of mine has a very nice modern convertible automobile, and my goodness, is it noisy. The very first automobile I owned, fresh out of college, was a Corvair convertible. And I never, to me, that was not a noisy car, but that was a lot of years ago, and I have a lot of automobile driving history since of four-door ordinary passenger vehicles. So soundproofing is an art and a science to it. And modern-day automobiles do a great job, and there's no way you can do it on a convertible that I know of. And boy, are they noisy. So Detroit and Japan with their automobiles are doing an extremely good job by my standards to do soundproofing. Therefore, I know it is possible on these motor generator sets. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call that is right now, K2RW in the TechNet.
VTM.
I just barely heard VTM, I think it was. Go right ahead.
Nick, Corvair is one of those cars I really like, even though they still don't sell too well. But I had a friend's convertible Corvair and used to drive that all around. And as kids, we thought that was, you know, that was the coolest thing. It made some noise, and that was great. But, back to the noise again. The sound deadening of a water-cooled engine is significant, and the sound mitigation from an 1800 RPM motor is also significant, and at 22 kW for a 1800 RPM motor generator set, you're looking at about just under $6,000, I believe. Over.
Okay, that's a possible approach, David. By the way, that Corvair that I own, a 1963 Corvair Monzer Spider convertible. In other words, it's the one with the supercharger. I remember repairing the supercharger, making sure it was in good operating condition. Went on the William Floyd Parkway on Long Island, brought that automobile up to some ridiculous speed just to see what it would do. And I remember driving to work the next day and driving out of the parking lot. The left front wheel fell off the car. It fell off because the cotter pin that holds in the castle nut for the bottom ball joint decided to walk itself off, and the last thread was stripped. Had that happened the night before, you wouldn't be hearing me today. What I realize is that one whole production run of 1963 Corvairs, the cotter pin was left out of the castle nut on the left-hand, on the driver's side ball joint. I remember seeing quite a significant number of Corvairs on the side of the road, disabled, because the front wheel had flopped off. And I suddenly realized, let me drop, that when, why can't I think of his name? The man who wrote the book, Unsafe at Any Speed. Can somebody tell me his name?
Ralph Nader.
That's the guy. Ralph Nader knew that a significant number of Corvairs had flipped over. He assumed that there was some kind of instability of the suspension system because each of those vehicles were heavily damaged in the accident. Nobody investigated why the left-hand front wheel was disconnected from the rest of the vehicle. They assumed that as a result of the accident. They didn't realize it was the cause of the accident. One whole production run was missing that cotter pin. And I still have that nut as a souvenir because that tiny piece of steel came very close to wiping me out. So his book, based on the assumption that it was instability of the suspension system, never having realized it was this missing cotter pin, is one interesting piece of history from my point of view. Anybody have any further questions or comments? We're drifting a little bit now away from generators and uninterruptible power for our houses. But I worry a little bit about, let me drop.
N1YDY with a Corvair comment.
Okay, we're going to go to you in a second. Let me get a beep. I worry about the fact that we amateurs who are going to be required to give communication service in the next few days is my belief. And how many of us have sufficient standby power to be able to do that if Con Ed and LIPA and New Jersey Power and Light goes down is an interesting question. A lot of us have got mobile equipment, so from our automobiles, we can always do the job even if there isn't enough standby power in the house. Go right ahead, Hank, N1YDY. I wonder if you owned a Corvair. What are your experiences? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, well, I'm down to one. But I actually had a business for a while when I worked for Grumman. My side business was first rehabbing Porsche 914s, which were the Volkswagen-powered kind of pancake-looking cars that were available. And they became a little pricey because I didn't like them as much as they liked the 911s. I got out of that and got into Corvair, and I actually had a little side business going on. So the Ralph Nader actually is, let me drop it. It's actually a discussion of what's called a transverse leaf spring, first generation. I'm sure you probably know about Corvair too, fundamental generation. There's the upright, sort of roundish one that they made from 1919, modern looking set of Corvairs from 1960. Later had already done this thing. So actually put a very complex rear suspension in the 65 suspension, actually a scaled down copy of the Corvette rear suspension. The earlier ones had this thing called a transverse leaf spring. They put it on the Monza, Turbo Monza, that's the model name for the turbocharged earlier ones. To make a long story short, GM was trying to save $2.48 per car. BMs were trying to get them on performance vehicle. What happened was the car was what's called ultimate oversteer, so when it went too fast around a corner, the rear end, where the mass of the engine would be, would break away from traction. And what would happen is the left rear wheel would tuck under the right rear wheel would tuck under the car without anything to hold it in place. You lost control because of centrifugal force. All that centrifugal operation. But basically, you end up with mighty wide.
Yeah, with that Corvair, by the way, the one with the turbocharger in 1963 was called Corvair Monza Spider. Spider is the one with the turbocharger. And the Spider version not only had the turbocharger, but it also was decambered. In other words, they adjusted the swing axle in such a way that the rear of the car sat a little bit lower, and therefore the the wheels were a little bit more stable. And yes, 63% of the mass of that car was in the back of the car, not in the front. And yes, it was extremely easy to make it go around corners in such a way that it would swing around back end first, if you know what I mean. And I used to have a lot of fun with snowy days in a parking lot doing spins with that automobile. And so you could learn to drive with it and with its crazy characteristics. And so I'm having trouble believing that all of the flipovers that he thought was instability of the suspension system was that, as opposed to what happens when the lower ball joint disconnects and your wheel is no longer being held with pressure down to the pavement. The wheel now rides up against the fender, and if you're rolling forward, the car will roll over that wheel, over that fender, and it flips the car. And so can the suspension in the rear cause a wheel to fold under? Somebody may have come up with that analysis. Did that really happen? I'm a little bit skeptical, but we'll have to look into that a little bit more. Alrighty, I think we've gone through a reasonable amount of generator information tonight, way beyond the point where we should have gone over the Paul's space report. And I think we're about to get space report number 100.
Repeater, timeout.
I think I'm about to get space report number 133. It's a rough guess on my part, Paul. What has NASA been doing? WS2N, our space reporter, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
N1LF.
Okay, Dick, I heard another station. Yeah, it is 133. You going to pick up the other station, or should I go?
I sounded like N1LF, N1 Lima Foxtrot. Correct me, tell us your name, and then proceed. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Alpha Lima Foxtrot. November 1, Alpha Lima Foxtrot. Drop over here in Greenwich, Connecticut, across the pond from you. Your friendly firefighter. And I guess I missed the subjects of generators tonight there. I heard a gentleman about grounding it. I've never come across an incident with any problems of grounding your generator out separate because you're basically your whole system is grounded out. And as Dick would know, I'm not a fan of backfeeding there. So we'll go on to the space thing and maybe another time I can give another seminar on generators. I just want to stop and say 73 to everyone. Be safe with your generators. Don't get any carbon monoxide into the house there. N1LF, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you say it so extremely fast, we don't hear the A. Let me drop it. N1 Alpha Lima Foxtrot. Now, I should have mentioned the word grounding. You got to be careful with that one. Because I think in most generators, the so-called hot and return leads are isolated from the case of the generator, I believe. But they're not positive. And yes, if you're using a three-wire system, the grounding pin on the generator and the grounding pin of the house should make it safe. To be on the conservative side, you should also sink a ground rod near the generator and connect that to the case of the generator. In the worst-case situation, if the generator did have one of its leads connected to its case, and if you have the system with your back feeding improperly wired, you can end up with the case of the generator 120 volts above ground. In that particular case, if you're foolish enough to go out there and decide you're going to refill the gas tank while it's running or some other very foolish operation, and you're standing on wet soil and you come in contact with the case of that generator, there's a slim chance that an electrocution possibility exists. So grounding of the generator is something you should definitely consider. It's one of the things that is a potential danger. That and carbon monoxide. Let me drop. There are people, of those 500 people that I was selling generators to, so to speak, a number of them was going to put the generator in their basement. My goodness, is that a bad, bad move. For only about four reasons. The noise would be deafening in the house. Gasoline in the house is something that should never be there. You spill one cup of gasoline on the floor of your basement of your house and let it evaporate and become an explosive mixture, and then a spark explodes that mixture, it will remove the roof from your house, and you might not survive it. On top of that, these motor generator sets have a significant amount of vibration when they're running. No matter what you use to conduct the exhaust system,